This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Yes, yes, everybody! You know the drill. We've started this podcast to help anyone who is remotely interested in trapping and neutering animals. We're the help we did not receive when we first wanted to get involved, and we want to be your new besties in the TNR world. I'm Alex, one of your hosts for this ride, and I'm so grateful to have Adele by my side. Hey, Adele!
Hey, Alex. Nice to see ya.
Yeah, nice to see you too. I'm excited for today's episode.
Yeah, today is round two of talking with Samantha Supaya. So we had a really cool first episode with Sam, where we were talking about organizing mass spay neuter events, which she has done really effectively in the Metro Manila area of the Philippines. So today we're going to continue talking about her work there in stray cat care. Just to give another little intro for Sam. So Sam is a vegan stray cat carer and animal welfare organizer living in the South Metro Manila area, specifically focusing in stray-centric care, biosecure spay and neuter events, neonate kitten care, and providing training and support to local stray carers. And all of this fits into her approach to decolonial urbanism, which is her specialty, and a lot of which she has drawn experience on when being involved in stray care. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that today. Sam, do you want to kick us off by sharing a little bit about some of the specific systemic barriers that you've faced when working in stray care in Manila?
Yeah, thank you, Adele. It's great to be back for this chat. Some of the systemic barriers that I've learned are really hard to push on. The first, I would say, would be poor awareness and enforcement of animal welfare laws, especially in the Global South. I know this happens in the Global North as well, but I think there's a different level of impunity in the Global South that relates to a lot more extreme events happening of animal abuse and animal hoarding, etc. And the just lack of action taken, even when authorities are repeatedly told of certain incidents. For example, the Soy Dog Foundation, which is a really well-known stray dog animal welfare group that works out of Thailand. It's funded by, I think, Americans, mostly. So they fund local law enforcement. Actually, so in order to investigate and raid the dog meat trade here in the Philippines. So this is a foreign funding who themselves are foreign, who are helping local actors here in the Philippines to actually carry out law enforcement, because otherwise it's not being done. That's what's happening. So this is something that, of course, local police teams are already paid to do, but they don't do it. And these are actually the only people in the Philippines I am aware of who are actually implementing animal welfare laws in the Philippines.
That sounds like it's not supposed to be that way.
I mean, if you have a country and that country has laws and you hire a police force and that police force doesn't respect the law, then what do you have? Do you really have a country? I think, you know, that's a worthwhile question to ask. So there's this lack of responsibility, essentially, that's being done by the authorities themselves. And then there's this, you know, specific individuals, right, who are consistently failing to take that responsibility. Because yes, it can be a systemic or a cultural problem, but there's also an onus, which is on the individual itself, who chooses to continue to neglect that responsibility. So for example, we're talking about specific individuals within local government units, and especially I put a lot of blame on the city vets themselves, the municipality's veterinary offices, to fulfill their responsibilities, especially when they are exposed in the public and judged by the media. This doesn't encourage them to change their behavior. which is really shocking for me to learn how, you know, the extent to which that is being done in the Philippines. So there is this systemic neglect by not only the city mayors and local politicians to allow this stuff to happen, but also by senators, the lawmakers of this country. What is the point of making laws when there's no enforcement mechanism?
Yeah, because that's what I was going to say. I was like, at least, like, if a country already has animal well-being in their law, that shows, you know, some progress on one side. But yeah, if it's not enforced, then what's the point?
A lot of, I think, like our regions think that, a lot of societies, especially in the global north, like, we're a country of animal lovers, we have great animal welfare laws in place, so like everything is fine. And we see that a lot of times in the form of welfareism laws. Mm-hmm. I know we talk about animal welfare as like an overarching umbrella, but a lot of what we're talking about in our circle is animal rights, and that is distinctly different to animal welfareism, which is just laws around improving welfare under a system that still exploits those animals. So we'll see that in things around wild species care. We'll see that around farm species care, but we will also see it in like legal wild animal pet trade or even domestic dog and cat care. We can see welfareism in puppy mills and kitten mills and backyard breeding and all these things. So yeah, it's definitely an important distinction that just because you have laws doesn't mean they're being enforced, and doesn't mean that they exist to protect the animals and the animals are doing great.
And I think there's two ways that I think about that. So what are the incentives for people to make laws but then don't enforce them, right? I can think of two things. The first is performativeness. So lawmakers in that country, who are the senators and, you know, the politicians, the big name politicians, want to be seen as progressive. They want to be seen, especially by the outside world, that their country is like developing, right? So this is the thing, that a lot of people, a lot of the, let's say, academic or elite world within that country wants to be involved in lawmaking, and they want to show off that there's this thing that we have, that it's a law. But on the other hand, they don't necessarily want to place budget on enforcing those laws. Or when they do place budget, they're placing it in a way that it can actually be accounted for something else. So for example, why is it that in a country in which people still die from rabies, you are using the allocation for the rabies budget in order to cull stray cats, when almost every rabies death in the Philippines is from a bite from a dog?
That's a great question.
Ask this question to the city municipality, to the vet himself, the one in charge of enforcing this and putting the budget. And his answer is, yeah, but people don't know that, and we need to fix the population issue. He said that to me to my face.
Oh my God.
I think we have a somewhat similar situation here in Greece. And everything you've just described breeds a lot of anger and frustration from people who are deeply entrenched in on-the-ground animal rescue towards municipalities, government bodies, police force, whoever, because they've proclaimed to take responsibility for these things like animal abuse or management of cat and dog populations. They've even been given budgets to do that, and yet we don't see the fruits of that. So in Greece, it's written into the most recent welfare law that municipalities are responsible for the sterilization, rabies vaccination, and microchipping of all stray animals. Do we see that happening? Well, we see small spay and neuter efforts here and there, but they're kind of sporadic, they're kind of small scale, they're not coordinated, and they don't result in this better managed, more well population of animals. And the individuals who are doing a lot of the rescue are running around trying to keep up and are reaching out for support and not receiving it. So what's the point of having that law if it's not actually helping the individuals it says it's supposed to? What's the point of this budget going towards these municipalities in order to do that work if it's not being done? And on the other side, sometimes this work is being done. Sometimes they are making efforts to do it, but perhaps it's the way they're doing it. Perhaps it's the vets they choose to partner with, or perhaps that they're not talking about it. They're not being transparent about what they're doing and working with the other rescuers. So it results in a lot of frustration in people who just think, what's the point of having these laws and all this funding if nothing is happening?
And, you know, this is the thing about why I say performativeness, because if you really wanted to solve the issue, but you didn't have a budget, lawmakers have enough imagination and education to know that you can actually make feeding stray animals a crime instead.
Definitely. And we've actually seen this pigeon management in different cities as well. It's something that's happening in Germany right now. Even though there has been proven methods of caring for urban pigeon flocks and also doing reproductive care in the form of swapping eggs in wild pigeon nests in cities, the lawmakers are still pushing for bans on feeding them, you know, deterrents like pigeon spikes or straight up poisoning and glue traps. So yes, great question. Great question of why they choose to use these methods. I mean, that's one of the things that we wanted to discuss as well, is the ethics of TNVR versus mass culling. So we oftentimes see this approach of mass culling in different cities all over the world. It's happening right now in Morocco and Turkey, especially around dogs who are more, let's say, accessible by the public to intervene in their lives, whereas cats are a little bit more elusive and can hide in places that humans can't reach them. And we especially see these big pushes of culling around events that benefit tourism and large amounts of humans coming to an area for some capitalistic purpose, like a sports event.
Well, like what happened in Athens, right? Because when I was in Mexico with Maya from Pet Project Rescue, Maya was talking about how many dogs she used to see in Athens. And I was asking Adele, I was like, Adele, there's no stray dogs in Athens, right? And Adele was like, no, not anymore.
Yeah, not in the center. I mean, it's pretty well known that all the dogs are rounded up and put in municipal shelters, which, as we know, are pretty much like a death sentence in a lot of cases. But plenty of areas outside of the center have free roaming dog populations and they're not cared for. And a lot of people are really afraid of them. And there's basically very little work happening for them. And a lot of people view the appropriate response is to call somebody to come get them, take them away, or they just poison them and get rid of the problem. So yeah, is there anything that you want to share about this ideology, Sam, sort of like from a perspective of putting an ideology over an actual strategy that is really effective of solving the thing that you want to solve?
I started thinking about and doing more research on when I was trying to understand how TNVR is done in practice, especially in the Global South. So the reality is that, you know, even with the tough situation in the Global North, there is a possibility for TNVR to actually be a better solution than mass culling. There is a practical, like logistical possibility for that to happen. Right? Even if it's funded by the stray carers themselves, there are ways to do like awareness campaigns because, you know, culturally there's more space to take those types of responsibilities on. And in the Global South, especially when you look at, again, you know, we were talking about in our last conversation, the lack of resource that stray carers are often facing. And then because of their ideology around animal ethics and welfare, they are essentially being forced to spend what little resource they have on fewer and fewer animals in order to do TNVR rather than essentially allow the municipality to simply continue with their plans anyway of stray culling. So what ultimately ends up happening is this emotional conflict within the stray carer, which causes fatigue, exhaustion, and then disappointment, disillusionment, and then usually quite quickly after that, they crash out of stray care. So when we are looking at the practicalities of mass TNVR in Global South urban contexts, where the municipality has no interest whatsoever in even enforcing basic animal welfare laws, you have to ask yourself about, like, well, what's the strategy here? How is this going to play out? What would be more effective for me to actually put my weight behind, given, you know, the little, whatever power, privilege, and access I have, how should I actually advocate for what kinds of strategies? Because when we look at studies of TNBR versus mass culling, the reality is that for contexts such as in Global South urban contexts in particular, mass culling is the more ethical option. It allows for less generations to be born to horrible, horrible situations. And this is mainly because of the ineffectiveness of the way that TNBR is applied. And when you compare that to the statistics that we have, a very few statistics that we have around how rampant deadly viral diseases and parasitic concerns are spreading around extremely dire population situations, such as here in Metro Manila, the suffering, you need to take into context the suffering that entire generations of stray animals are going through when TNBR is just allowed to continue when it's not effective necessarily compared to something like mass culling. It seems extremely dire to say that, but the reality is that that is the situation of population crises in Global South urban centers, that people are feeding them or they're eating from trash or whatever it is. They're suffering in their diet in the first place. They're picking up horrible diseases, parasites, the, you know, how few neonates actually make it. It's truly insane. And then let alone, we haven't even spoken about the climate crisis, typhoons, big storms, floods, you know, everything that is out to just create more suffering. And then you look at mass culling as the option that Global South cities actually can resource.
It's a huge shame knowing that this is kind of the logical eventuality of public governmental groups' approach to managing free-roaming animals, when we know methods like TNVR, when done strategically, can be really effective. There's always going to be threats to their well-being. The TNVR programs are not designed to help animals live forever, but it's to intervene in a constant cycle of future suffering. So preventing reproduction so that future suffering doesn't happen, and try to alleviate the immediate suffering as much as possible, especially to the degree that you and the other stray carers around you do. You're doing highly individualistic, high quality one-on-one care to ensure that the colonies you're helping have the best possible chance of not just surviving, but thriving as much as a free roaming animal can. And we've seen great success in strategically implemented TNVR programs. And when we're talking about strategy, we're talking about putting all of our resources area by area, colony by colony, and having a good idea of the area that we're going to be working in, having mapped the individuals that we're going to be helping, and all of the resources and barriers we have to deal with prior to doing that work, and also having the resources to do that work. We've seen populations, free-roaming animal populations, do better, be stable, not constantly exponentially grow, and human communities be happier and coexist with them better. But that's not the reality of government-run, municipal-run programs. They're either picking animals here and there, or letting people bring in, you know, 100 female cats over 6 months of age from the entire island or the entire city, and it has absolutely no material effect on the population management itself. So no wonder these government bodies think just killing them all is a better approach.
And from what I started out researching, I would have to agree. There is no resource to do things in a proper way. And if it were me, like if I was part of a species that was overpopulated in this way and I was suffering, I'd like the suffering to end faster rather than in a drawn out, painful, horrible way.
One thing you mentioned before is the prevalence of these international NGOs who come to a place in the Global South and set up some kind of, it's usually a rescue operation, and also try to infuse some TNVR into that. We see that a lot more these past years from the UK as well, American organizations, right? Also Australian organizations. But a lot of these nonprofits tend to come and kind of like infuse themselves and their brand into the rescue community. And they tend to focus on rescue and potentially in like quite a white saviorist way and platform themselves rather than trying to prop up the local actors who have been doing things like spay and neuter and rescue for a long time and would probably prefer spay and neuter rather than rescuing all these animals and trying to ship them overseas for thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, for exactly the thing that you mentioned, the way that I interpret it is there are two different processes going on. The first is what we call development aggression in the indigenous rights space. I don't know if you've heard of it, but essentially development aggression happens in the stray care world in two ways. The first is urban development itself. So essentially that you're rapidly changing the environment in which these animals live, and that is a threat on their lives, that's a threat on their health, that's a threat on their food sources, their water sources, everything. So that's why it's called development aggression, because it's being done by an outside force to change your basic circumstances. And the second way is precisely this idea of what a developed country should be like, how it should treat its animals, etc., that's coming from outside, which is an imposition, a foreign imposition that happens a lot since colonial times, especially in places like the Philippines, which are extremely sort of like open and friendly to Western ideas. Western ideas that they don't have resource to implement. So it leads into these cycles of just like, you know, more from these different ways that development aggression is perpetuated. And then the other side of the coin for me is the lack of collaboration potential amongst local stray carers. So there's this outside force imposing its ideas, right, through development aggression. And then there's no opposition to that, essentially, because there is a lack of collaboration even amongst people who are working, you know, like a few streets down from each other. There's this lack of trust that is very, very rampant here in the Philippines, in particular, across the stray care community, because of egotistical saviorism. And for me, this comes from vulnerable narcissism here in particular, and especially like, you know, people who identify with stray care because they themselves are abused, right? And so they treat the animal the way that they wish they were treated. And because they continue to be abused, so they continue to treat the animal in this way. And so this becomes something about their identity. They cannot lose their work in stray care. And so they continue getting burnt out. They continue believing in the saviorism narrative of this like ethics, ideology, etc., that they cannot actually ever be able to carry out because of the lack of resource. And so this just spirals into this vulnerability narcissism, where it's like, I'm not getting my needs met, and all I care about is like getting these needs met. And so you just feed the false self that is just telling yourself like, yeah, there's like 30 animals in one room, but like I'm saving all of them.
This is exactly what we see turn into situations of hoarding and low quality of care, would you say?
This is exactly it. So this is what I'm talking about, that's creating this weird identity complex that is just like extremely unhealthy and based on self-hatred, self-abuse, because of to receive, either it's from society or from lack of economic opportunity or directly from like domestic abuse, which is very widespread in places like the Philippines and other obviously global South contexts because of urban trauma. So this is what I'm talking about in terms of how urban trauma can manifest, and especially in extremely colonized places like the Philippines, where we're talking about like 500 years of colonization. And so what happens when people have this identity complex of anxiety and depression, and nothing, no matter how hard anyone tries, they're not, and so you become this like suicidal person whose entire identity is wrapped around saviorship, when you're actually potentially just doing abuse, right? This is the extremity of narcissism that I see happening that usually leads to a lot of the systemic abuse that is happening, that people, you know, like people who care about them, like their family members, etc., don't feel like they can actually properly bring up or mention because it's such a knife's edge situation, right? With regards to that person's health. But the whole thing is just like highly, highly unhealthy. And so these are the people who see themselves as in competition with others because they are gaining, unfortunately, views and donations. Other people doing that, they feel like they're in competition with them. And so this is really what essentially reduces the general amount of trust among stray carers, because there's a lot of this going on, even if you're not the one doing it, but you're not ever really sure, can you trust someone else? Just because of like the way that you're showing up online or how you're curating, right? That false image to be, you have no idea. You really never know unless you're doing things offline. And so this is usually what leads to this competition narrative on the level of, like, you know, people who are seeking donations or support online on social media. And then there's this other weird narrative going on that I think is more common amongst stray carers who have more financial resource, where essentially they see themselves as some sort of ethical influencer, some sort of, like, you know, a superwoman who comes in like Kitten Lady and just knows everything about what to do. And then now they're in competition with other people who actually might know better than them, actually, right? So there's this competitive nature that's, again, built around identity, which is, again, built around ego, because they're using the animals for their own ego, not stray-centric care or animal-centric care. This is the foundation for what I have experienced and my understanding of what is happening in the Philippines that leads to this lack of collaboration.
Samantha, you've mentioned in the previous episode that you've had a sort of role of facilitator as a foreigner in those collaboration relationship. How did you jump into that role and how did you handle it when there's so much mistrust and ego and all of what you talked about right now?
Well, it's very similar to how we go about looking for local government units to support stray care. So I look for people who say that they're willing to contribute and who I don't think are leading with ego first. And there are many. There are many. They are the ones who tend not to have the big social media accounts. They're the ones who don't post every day, right? But they are definitely the ones who, when you post a tip, for example, about neurotoxic spot-ons and how to avoid them, they're the ones who would be writing to you to say, thank you so much, like, this really helped me. And then that's the only way that you would know, actually, they are a stray carer. And then, so it's through those kinds of, you know, communications that you build relationship and you start to have this opportunity to talk more about, like, other practices, like, what are you doing? Because usually they would also, once they trust you, essentially, to share useful tips, they would then also, you know, potentially share a problem that they're working through and ask for advice or things like that. And that's where I might say, oh, I was just talking to someone else who had a similar problem, etc. So this is really not different to what's already happening, I think, within the stray care community, where people are looking to reach out to each other to, like, ask for advice. I think the problem more so is about lack of awareness, lack of knowledge. And so there's a whole bunch of people who are looking to ask each other for advice and nobody knows what to actually do. And just being a part of that, you know, being a part of that network and, like, contributing in any way that I can. The biggest way that I was able to do that was for the neonate care group that I ended up starting up, because I wanted to do an experiment where we share resources for neonate care. So there was a period of time that there were just, like, we had two incubators and they were just, like, being sent from household to household to be used for neonate care. And then it came with all of this instruction. It came with a support group. It came with, like, 24-hour emergency support on text message and all these things. And it ended up really useful for people in terms of, like, the training, even though I don't have to be there specifically, but just having someone to answer your questions or to do research for you or to be able to like make suggestions, you know, that is a big help to be training people to take care of new situations that they otherwise just would be up in arms and, you know, or potentially make a mistake and then cause themselves a lot of distress. But when you are being advised by somebody who's done this many times before and advised many people before, you feel less stressed. And because of that, you are able to deliver better care, even with, you know, the limited resource. And this neonate care group also came with individuals who were really passionate about that and really wanted to keep donating to that space. So there were people constantly topping up our supplies. Because of that, every time we needed to send supplies to the next address, that everything fit into the incubator again and like send it on. So there were like medications, there were pee pads, there were heaters, there were stuffed toys, there were like everything. This thing had everything. It had the heartbeat simulator. It was amazing. So that's how I know it's possible. That's the way that we did it. And I never had to go to anyone's house. I think I went to two people's houses to show them how to syringe feed very young neonates. But otherwise, like, you know, folk were doing it on their own.
It's this collaborative approach that is really going to continue the work and improve the work farther than us as individuals can actually do ourselves. Like, this training and skill sharing and resource sharing is such a core part of doing all of this strategically and better to ensure that everything doesn't come back to us as the one person front and center who is responsible for making the whole wheel go round.
Yeah, so this is the thing. You do tend to just become that person anyway, as I mentioned, that when you step out, like some things crash out. And sometimes you have to step out just to see if it will stand on its own, you know, and to allow the chips to fall where they may. Because like after 2 years of being mainly the one who would be, you know, answering text messages in the middle of the night, there's like 25 people on this group chat, and any single one of these people have like been through all of these before, like all the different times before where we have done this, and I am still the one who's like doing that, right? And so I started identifying individuals. This is usually what I do anyway as part of like teams that I'm leading. I identify individuals who I think could take on those roles, and essentially I have to assign them to like, you know, sort it out. Like, what are the shifts? Are you doing this for this person? Are you doing that for that person? You know, what issues are you having that you could preempt, etc. And ultimately, I mean, I personally see this as a really bad thing, but I became known to the Animal Welfare Society here, so the Philippine Animal Welfare Society. I became known to them as the person who takes care of neonates. And whenever they had inquiries, they would like message me about it. And I was like, no, I'm not your dumping ground. This is not the project. The project is collaboration. And so this was the point, essentially, that I understood that, okay, the project has failed. I've had some really good learnings and experiences about it. I see where it could be possible, but the reality is there's just not enough resource. You know, if I had the budget, for example, to set up teams like this across the country, that would be a different question.
What do you think about the collaboration, not just between individuals across communities or individual influencers, but collaboration with these bigger organizations and humane societies or larger clinics or shelters?
With regards to clinics or shelters, I would say that, again, it comes down to your agreement with them. I think with every collaboration, there's going to be an area of alignment that you can find, and this needs to be part of the agreement, and roles and responsibilities need to be set out very clearly. If it's not working out, it's not working out. Don't push it. Just move on. Everybody has better things to do with their lives. There's you know, millions of people to work with. There's no problem here. You tried it. There's no hard feelings. With regards to larger organizations, in particularly on a national level or an international level, I'm just not interested. They come with a very strong sort of like narrative, protocols, etc., that just don't apply in the local context, and just like the big egos that come with that. I'm just like very turned off by massive organizations who, you know, come with, okay, this is how you're going to do it. Step 1 through 400, you know, and without any respect, essentially, for the work that's already been done on the ground. I know that, you know, not every organization takes things in that way, but this tends to be the case for larger organizations more than anything else. I think another aspect of why I personally reject larger organizations is because of decolonization, essentially. You know, creating that space for white supremacy, like any risk of white supremacy, for me is just like big no. Just can't do it. Even though I think, like, you know, stray care is obviously highly dominated by Western veterinary approaches, I do actually promote remedies, home remedies, herbal remedies, for example, just because they're more accessible for people. And it gives them something that they can actually, you know, they have time, and they're willing to like spend hours and hours taking care of the animals, but they just don't have the money to take an animal to the vet, because, you know, a lot of times vets, especially, you know, like in rural areas, are just so far out of budget. It's really insane. So like I don't personally see much benefit in doing things in a way that continues to colonize, essentially. And I haven't found a large organization who isn't trying to do that.
We also see that they are the ones who go to these international conferences and are invited to the table to talk about the very successful intervention that they did in other places. And like you said, not every organization is like that. Like, signs of a better format would be deferring to the local knowledge, deferring to the local people, and acknowledging that they have their own standards and have been doing this work for a long time to prop up what they're doing, to build that bridge, to facilitate rather than impose some kind of non-culturally specific approach.
Right. But so my question to them, even if they're trying to do things in that way, is, well, so why does your organization exist?
Mm-hmm.
Why does it exist in the way that you do? Shouldn't you simply be like a fundraising organization to then just direct funds without having your own operations? What is the point of having your own operations then?
We do need to take a quick break, but we'll be back with Samantha for just a few more questions before we wrap up the episode.
You know the expression, cats have 9 lives. Well, what if you can give them one more? The Give Them 10 movement is on a mission to help give cats an extra life. How? With spay and neuter. Spaying or neutering your cat helps them live a longer, healthier life. And it helps control free-roaming cat populations, too. Learn more about the benefits of spay and neuter and meet Scooter, the neutered cat, at givethem10.org. That's givethem10.org.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
All right, we're back with Sam for some closing thoughts to this information-packed episode. A lot of really interesting considerations for all of us to implement in our advocacy. Is there anything else that you would suggest for people when thinking about their advocacy of where to focus their efforts?
Yeah, so there's 4 areas. The first, fundraising, very difficult one, but necessary to talk about. The second is about low-cost spay and neuter services. The third is about early education. And the fourth is about Stray Care Academy. So starting with the first on fundraising, this is always going to be difficult. As I said about the so-called philanthropy space with international or national funding, I think this is always going to be essentially taken up by people who just have the loudest voice, and not everyone has access to that. So I would really recommend for folk to engage their neighborhood businesses and other private businesses that you can get access to who have a direct vested interest in essentially like improving the local area. This is the number one thing that I would say would be the most dependable source of funding, even if it starts small. It would really last in like far into the future and would really benefit the not only the cat colonies that you are targeting to serve, but also the relationships between the people who would then be seeing and interacting with this cat colony. So a lot of things can happen when you do things on a very local scale. But as I said, this might take time also to change attitudes around the area. And so this is a long-term case of simply like building those relationships and building that trust to show the effects of ethical stray care. The second I mentioned was to encourage low-cost spay and neuter services at local veterinary clinics. So this is something easily done through advocacy, going and speak to vets at those clinics. And I would say actually to prioritize this over mass spay and neuter events, just because mass spay and neuter events have so many things that could go wrong. Whereas at clinics, especially your neighborhood clinics, if they are offering low-cost services, it's a much, much safer option. So I would highly recommend this. It would not only benefit your colony, it would benefit many, many other people who might not be thinking about being able to take up stray care just because the cost is so prohibitive. But if they know that there are low-cost services in the area, even without your intervention and without you knowing about them, they'll be able to start on their own. The third I mentioned was early education, advocacy campaigns at schools, for example, or to be able to conduct or be part of local or national campaigns, especially those that are led by political leadership. I think these things are really important about intervening in the early education space. So this is essentially the only fix that I could think of when thinking about a prohibitive culture towards animal welfare. And then finally, the fourth was Stray Care Academy. So essentially, this is not a sanctuary. This is not a shelter or anything like that. But it's a place where people can go to learn how to responsibly care for strays and to help find support for their initiatives. This needs to be done offline as much as possible and to share skill sets and suppliers. You know, vet supplies, litter box supplies, just basic things, you know, sharing remedies that work, even if they're not veterinary approved, let's say, but there are things that can help strays when used in responsible ways. So a place to learn and share knowledge, I think, amongst stray carers. That's what I'm calling the Stray Care Academy idea. So these are the four areas I would suggest for people to consider when thinking about where to place their advocacy efforts.
That is wonderful, Samantha. I love the Stray Care Academy. I love the name. That is what it is. Yeah.
Yeah, I was really interested to be able to set this up. At one point, I was looking for funding. I had a potential funder, but that fell through. And then that was also one of the many points that I reached burnout. And so it wasn't something I took on. Hopefully, I'll be able to come back to this idea. I'm still looking for people who are interested to collaborate on this idea in the local scene and to build something that can last, like, you know, beyond ourselves.
Do you want to share how people can get in contact with you or follow your work?
Yes. So you can follow our work. Our volunteer team is called Saudis Strays. So you'll be able to find us online there. And also for my work on urbanism, that would be at urbandonut.asia.
Thank you so much, Samantha, for joining us today and the previous episode. We really appreciate you sharing all of your knowledge and experience with us and our listeners. And yes, we would also really love to hear about your experience for everybody who's listening to us. So if you have any questions, any feedback, anything you want to tell us, just send us a DM on either Saving Lives with 2 A's or Travel Animal Rescue on Instagram. And see you all at our next episode. And in the meantime, stay out of trouble and keep trapping to save the streets one animal at a time.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.